Hello everyone, and thank you for listening to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. This episode was sponsored by William Hill. You can download the William Hill app to put the world of betting at your fingertips. Available in the Apple App Store and Google Play, you must be over 18 and please do gamble responsibly. All odds mentioned in this episode were correct at the time of recording. My name is Jake Entwistle, and I was joined by three familiar Squawker Talker voices to review the winter transfer window, focusing on the winners and losers in the Premier League and picking out some interesting deals you might have missed from around Europe. We also spoke to William Hill ambassador Robbie Savage to get his thoughts on the window and which clubs are best set up to finish the season strong, as well as learning a little bit more about what it's like to join a struggling club in January and the pressure that comes with it. So first up on this episode, we're going to be discussing the biggest winners and losers from the Premier League from the January transfer window. And joining me to do that, as I said, are familiar Squawker Talker voices, the first of which is chief writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome back.
Hey, Jake. How you doing? How you doing, everyone? Glad to be back. It's a podcast. Hooray.
Also joined by chief editor at Squawker, Will Hall, who I'm assuming won't be as thrilled.
No. Equally thrilled. Thank you, Jake.
And another guest, Oliver Young-Miles, football journalist, former Squawker Talker regular, returning for some insight. Welcome back, Ollie.
Thank you. It's great to be back on. I think it's the first time since last March.
Wow.
So it's almost the anniversary.
Wow. I know. Too long.
Once a year is all you're coming on for now, but that means it's going to be extra special when we get your insight. In January, according to The Guardian, Premier League clubs completed 172 deals worth £84.6 million, which compared to last season of £265 million, is a massive drop-off. It was more a case of loan deals and shrewd signings this January. And in terms of the biggest winners, I'm going to start with you, Will. Who do you think had the most successful window in terms of looking forward for how the rest of their season is going to pan out?
I don't think anyone set the bar very high. But I mean, Liverpool can take a bit of a my bad for failing to anticipate the injury problems of Fabinho, Jordan Henderson and Joel Matip before the window actually opened, when their only three experienced backups in central defence average around 10 games missed through injury each season, or at least have done since joining Liverpool. But my updated take is that Liverpool propelled themselves into the winners category through the business they did manage to get done on deadline day, mostly because it's better late than never, and the lateness isn't super relevant to Liverpool's January struggles, which derailed their title defence. I don't see any obvious way a new centre-back would have made much difference to the five-game stretch between beating Crystal Palace 7-0 and losing at home to Burnley in late January. Diogo Jota's injury seemed more costly than the centre-back situation over those games, in which they only conceded three goals from 13 shots on target, while conversely, despite averaging 71% possession, took a middling 14 shots on target and were, of course, the only team in the league who didn't score. So in short, they were average in attack and unlucky maybe at the back. But signing Ben Davis and Ozan Kabak and not putting all your eggs in one basket while fixing what would definitely have become a big problem over the rest of the season, especially in light of Matip's season-ending ankle ligament damage, is smart, especially when both in terms of player profiles, have concerns to go along with their positives. Davies' standout attribute is, statistically, his long-range passing, which is one of the things we know Liverpool look for in centre-backs. But the obvious red flag with his signing is that they bought him from Preston North End in the Championship. So I think it's clever to have a more established target, someone who, by all accounts, was on their shortlist last summer in Ozan Kabak, who's strong in duels, especially in the air, but also completed more take-ons than any Bundesliga centre-back since the start of last season. So a bit like Joel Matip in that sense, in that he wins loads of headers and for some reason Matip's roaming runs always tend to get mentioned on this podcast. But there's also a red flag in that he's played for a terrible Schalke team in the past two seasons. I think that's his only experience really of top-flight football, and does most of his defending in deep areas. So how adaptable he is to that Liverpool high line is one of the big questions they'll be needing to answer. So, yeah, spreading the risk across those two centre-backs is smart. And plus the Quebec transfer agreement seems to favour the buyer in a way you wouldn't associate typically with a last-minute deadline date deal. There's a £1 million loan fee, of course, but there's no obligation to buy. So Liverpool have managed to sign a serious target of last summer on almost like a six-month trial. And if he's a disaster or if he barely plays, you can kill the deal and go in for Upamecano if Bayern don't sign him first, or Chalatasar from Marseille. Or if he's remotely successful, I think less than 20 million looks like a good deal for someone with high resale value because of his age. And you'll have Gomez and Van Dijk hopefully back fit for next season anyway.
Yeah, you mentioned that obviously Matip was ruled out for the season, and then it followed up the next day, didn't it, that Van Dijk's injury was, again, Klopp was sort of tempering expectations of people that had started to whisper he might be appearing for the end of the season. It looks like they're going to be out without both of those. You mentioned the stat profiles there as well. Anyone that saw the graphic that we posted on Twitter as well, which I know I always seem to reference on audio platforms, but you can always try and find it afterwards. Quebec and Davis look like they would actually form a really balanced partnership based on the stats you mentioned. So another sign that Liverpool usually always seem to be a winner in the transfer window due to their recruitment. And even though it was last minute, they must have had both of these players, even if they were lower down on a shortlist. It seems like they were players that they may have been tracking or at least fit the profile that they were looking for. So well done again, Michael Edwards, I guess.
Yeah. Quebec. Yeah, as I said, he was mentioned in the papers last year for sure. Davies kind of seems to come out of nowhere.
Will, you mentioned there that maybe the bluntness in attack or maybe profligacy, which is a word I usually stumble on, was a reason that they were out of form. But do you think that adding the centre-backs to the squad, which means that, again, Henderson doesn't have to do his Javier Mascherano impression for the rest of the season, means that obviously Man City, with their recent run, have become clear favourites, but Liverpool are still going to be considered Premier League title contenders. Do you think these centre-backs give them a chance of defending their title, or maybe mean that their Champions League run might be a bit more positive?
I think where the lateness of Liverpool making their centre-back signings does come into it is that, knowing Klopp's approach to phasing players in, and in fact what he's said over the week in press conferences, it would be a huge surprise to see either of them start in the Manchester City game a week's time, which if lost, Liverpool's title race could end right there. I think if City go, would it be 7 points clear or 9 points clear? 7 points clear with a game in hand. Yeah, obviously, depending on the games that are yet to take place in the interval between this recording and when it goes out. So, yeah, I think over the course of the season, providing that Liverpool don't lose to Man City, it increases their chances in the title race, especially because just having a settled centre-back partnership is going to make it easier for Thiago to gel in midfield. He's been criticised in some quarters for his adaptation. I've been impressed by him, but there have been concerns raised about how he slows down play, and that could be a question of like not being on the same page with his teammates to the high levels that he was with Bayern Munich. And yeah, that applies to the Champions League as well, of course.
I think the major worry about Thiago is how frequently he's committing fouls
Fernandinho, isn't it? It's like, because yeah. I suppose that's where the defenders will help, right? Because they'll be in better positions, so he won't have to constantly be running back and covering for them. He can just be like, okay, you deal with that. Give me the ball and let me get going. Pace of play is interesting for Liverpool, though. It's very important. I think that's actually where Henderson at centre-back actually has been semi-useful, because the ball again for the first goal, you know, that was fantastic against Spurs. You know, lovely ball out the back. He's great at passing, so yeah.
And I think a lot of Thiago's fouls have been tactical fouls, and that might be motivated through not having quite the right amount of confidence in the back line behind him. But yeah, we've definitely seen a level of aggression that we might not have naturally expected when he was billed as this elegant, classy player coming to Liverpool like the new Xabi Alonso, who actually was also a bit of a tactical fouler himself.
But that's it, though, isn't it? He is. Xabi Alonso was a legendary tactical fouler at Real Madrid. He would just bang, 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 get away with it. Thiago seemed to have inherited that. The thing with Thiago is we expect him going forward, pressing, because he wins loads of tackles, doesn't he? The big stats was all his tackle stats at Bayern. But he would, that's because he was pressing. He winning them on the front foot. Now he's doing it on the back foot. But, you know, it's I'm just glad he's not been like, oh, I'm Premier League, it's so overwhelming. He's like, come on, lads, I can handle you. What have you got?
On the William Hill website, it's very much a three-horse title race now, with Man City 1-4, Liverpool 4-1, and Man United 12-1. The next team you can get is 66-1. So it looks like a couple of centre-backs are keeping Liverpool in it for as long as possible, but whether it is enough to defend their Premier League title, we'll have to see. So we've highlighted perennial winners of the transfer window, Liverpool, as maybe one side that will be happy with their dealings in the end. Ollie, I'm going to come back to you on your return to pick out the Premier League's biggest loser from the transfer window.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few candidates for this, considering it was one of the quietest windows that we've seen. But towards the bottom of the table, I've been surprised at how little activity has taken place. I think West Brom have done quite a lot of business. Maitland-Niles is a good signing for them, but besides West Brom, you're looking at Fulham and Sheffield United. I think they brought in one player between them, and of those three teams currently in the bottom three, there is like a bit of a gap starting to develop between them and the rest. Brighton are 7 points clear of Fulham in 18th, and I just thought Fulham would try and do a bit more in this window. Obviously, it's a tough time to bring anyone in, but they've shown real shoots of recovery recently without necessarily getting the results to go with it. And I think a key part of that has been the fact that they haven't had anyone to finish off the chances that they've been creating. They did manage to get one striker in through the door right at the last minute. Josh Maguire, the star of Sunderland Till I Die, has come in from Bordeaux on loan with a £9 million option to buy. So that is something. And, you know, he does sort of fit what they need in terms of a dynamic striker who can play in Parker's system. This season we've seen Ivan Cavallero and Ademola Lookman both playing up front over the past few weeks for Fulham. But they're both wingers, really, you know, playing out of position. They've got three goals apiece, which is not bad, and they've shown good glimpses. Cavallero scored a great header against Spurs a few weeks ago, and Lookman as well has been really lively, scoring against Man United the other week. But they're not clinical finishers, and Loftus-Cheek is another one who's sort of played up there in a different kind of role, more as a false nine, but he's struggling a little bit for form as well. So I think they really needed to get a proven goal scorer ready to come in straight away and make an impact. And in Maguire, they've got another exciting young player. He's only 22, but someone who might not be ready to come straight in and deliver the goals that they need to stay up. I was looking into the stats behind their issues in front of goal. And they're third lowest for the number of goals scored this season with 17. But the sort of alarming statistic that jumps out is that they've missed 22 of their 24 big chances, which is just not sustainable for a team down fighting for their lives at the bottom of the table. And a key thing with their business as well, I think Josh King was the obvious first choice target for them. And he is experienced, 29 years old, proven in the Premier League with 48 goals in 173 games for Bournemouth. I think he would have obviously been the key target. They missed out on him because he went to Everton, and Maguire is the sort of backup player to come in. And it's a big ask for him. You know, he scored 9 league goals in 2 years for Bordeaux. 3 of those came in one game, I think against Nîmes, about a year ago now. And his only record in England really is in League One with Sunderland, when he scored 15 in 24 games for them in the 2018-19 season. So it's asking a lot for him to come in and fire them to safety. I think the fact that they have got a dynamic mobile striker who can run the channels and assist Lookman and Cavallero is going to be useful for them. But it's just, as I said, asking a lot of him to expect him to file into safety.
Yeah, another stat that sort of links back to their desperate need to sign someone that can finish. Only Sheffield United have a lower conversion rate in the Premier League this season of 7% when you include block shots as well. So maybe they're just not being able to break down certain defences. Yeah, Fulham's is 7.36, which is, yeah, not inspiring if you're looking to stay up. You mentioned that obviously West Brom signed quite a few players just to lean on them as not a potential loser if you're highlighting Fulham as maybe not doing enough. Do you think any of those sides in the current three relegation places, obviously Sheffield United didn't sign anyone, but they've picked up a bit of form recently. Do you think it's too late for all those sides, regardless of what's happened? Fulham in particular, given you highlighted them as maybe the biggest loser.
Yeah, I think so. I think the current three are the three that will probably go down. The Brighton's win against Spurs over the weekend has really made quite a sizable gap. And as much as Fulham and Sheffield United have improved recently, they're still a long way off climbing that table. Just on Fulham again, I mean, they've collected 7 points in their last 10 games, all of which have been draws. And, you know, we're sort of looking at them as a team that have improved considerably, but that's the same amount of points that they picked up in the first 10 games because they won two. Both of their wins came in the first 10 games. So they've tightened up considerably, conceding 10 in their last 10 compared to 19 in their first 10. But it's just that scoring goals at the other end to win games and turn draws into victories. I'm just not sure if they're going to be able to do that. And we saw with West Brom yesterday, I mean, Sam Allardyce is probably in danger of losing his long record, because that result last night was a massive one for them, losing to Sheffield United. So, yeah, I just think in terms of quality and also in terms of the points that they need to make up, those three have got a real uphill battle to try and get out of it at this stage.
It's almost like there should be 5 points for a win to stop people thinking draws are good results. You might be unbeaten, but as you said, you can win two games and pick up as much. So interesting to see if, as you said, reality TV star Josh Maja can fire Fulham up the table, but it's going to be a very difficult ask for Scott Parker's side. And now we're welcoming on pundit, podcaster, director of football at Macclesfield, and pretty much everything else football related at the moment, William Hill ambassador Robbie Savage. Thank you for joining the Squawker Talker podcast. How are you finding it with so much football going on right now?
Do you know what, Jake? Football's my life. Football's always been my life. Very hectic, you know, as a pundit now, as you can imagine, so many games every single week. With my role as the new director of football at Macclesfield FC, trying to build a football club with my partner, Rob Smethurst. Not just the first team, but the academy, the whole structure of the football club, relaying the pitch, the bar area, the gym area. Very busy. So I'm trying to combine that with all my punditry and keeping on top of all the, you know, ongoings in the world of football. But listen, mate, I love it. We love it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you as well, you sort of hinted that something else might be coming soon to do with grassroots football as well. So I don't know whether that was sort of a bit tongue-in-cheek with the breaking news.
You know, as I'm a campaigner for grassroots sport, you know, and in what football in my particular case, with my partner Rob Smethurst as Macclesfield, we've had a big discussion and we've got something big to announce this week on Thursday, which I believe will have a massive positive effect on grassroots football in the local area. You know, I'm so excited to announce it. Hopefully, I think, you know, lots of people will be pleased. I can't say too much more, but yeah, something I'm really passionate about, and it's going to be huge. I believe it. I think it might be one of the first times it's happened. Might get a bit of criticism. You know what social media is like, Jake. Can't please everybody. But I think the positive aspects of what we're going to announce on Thursday will far outweigh the negatives.
Well, this podcast, we're looking to get it out on Thursday. So if you're listening, check Robbie's Twitter page as well. I'm sure there's plenty of stuff on there, or you've probably already seen it before you're listening. But we wanted to get you on to talk about what was a bit of a different transfer window, more loan deals probably than anything else, not much activity compared to last season, but there were some key signings on deadline day in particular, Liverpool signing centre-backs as well as people at the lower end of the table trying to make a push to stay in the Premier League. On this podcast, we've been discussing winners and losers of the Premier League transfer window and beyond, even if they didn't make any signings. Was there a signing that happened throughout the window or particularly deadline day that has really struck you as something that's going to make a difference to how the season's going to play out?
You talk about the transfer window. I think it was the lowest spend by Premier League clubs in a decade in the winter window, understandably. I'm looking at Josh King to Everton. You know, looking at transfer deadline day, it was Everton or Fulham. Everton have secured the services of Josh King. I think he'll be a real asset to Carlo Ancelotti's side, you know, pushing for a European place. You know, if Calvert-Lewin's not in the side, who's had a remarkable season, you know, Josh King, you know, with his pace, you know, his clever runs, his intelligence, I think he will do exceptionally well. When he was with Callum Wilson at Bournemouth, you know, they formed a great relationship. Has had an experience at a big club, you know, at Manchester United as a youngster, played international football for Norway. So I think he'll be a real asset to Carlo Ancelotti's side. So I think Josh King is a real good one. Liverpool, as you say, signing a couple of centre-backs, especially that's now more important as, you know, I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jake, that Matip is going to be out for the season, which is a huge blow. When will Van Dijk come back? You know, we don't know when that's going to be and how long it will take him to actually get back to full speed. So I think, you know, the centre-backs Liverpool have signed are young. You know, Ben Davis. It's a great opportunity. So I would say Liverpool, by signing two centre-backs, that might allow Jordan Henderson to go back into midfield because they're missing out there. So Liverpool have done okay. And you've got to say West Brom, Jake. Sam Allardyce had to get players in to try and get West Brom to survive. It takes me back to when I was at Derby, Jake, when I moved to Derby in the January and we were, I think we had 7 points and, you know, that team goes down as the worst Premier League team in points total history. And what Derby tried to do then was to try and get players in to survive in the Premier League and it didn't work out. West Brom, I think they got 4 or 5 in, you know, Maitland-Niles, very good signing. So Big Sam knows the transfer market. Those signings, will they keep West Brom in the Premier League? Time will tell, but they've given themselves a real opportunity, like our Derby team did. But inevitably, you know, we weren't good enough. And it boiled down to the fact that, you know, we didn't have enough quality in the squad. So West Brom are still in touch, though. That's the big thing. And Big Sam, 6 relegation battles he's been involved in, and he's survived every time. So with the recruitment of the 4 or 5 he's brought in, you know, starting with Snodgrass earlier in the window, they've got an opportunity now.
What's it like then to lean on that experience of joining a side that's struggling in January? What's the atmosphere like at a club when you come in and people maybe expect you to be the one making the difference? Is that difficult to deal with, or is that going to fire up new players?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jake. You know, I was at Blackburn, had a broken leg, hadn't fully recovered, started to get back to full fitness, and I wanted to play regular. So I decided to go and take the challenge of Derby. And I must say, Jake, that there was so much expectation on myself to try and keep that side up. And I wasn't the same type of player where I could tear around a football pitch, making challenges, you know, using my energy, my enthusiasm to get the ball back to better players, because basically there weren't better players technically in the team. So as before, when I was giving the ball to Muzzy, is it a Leicester or two guy at Blackburn or Christoph Dugri at Birmingham, you know, at Derby, good players, but they weren't difference makers. Where in the other teams I'd play for, I could do what I was good at, and get the ball to the more creative players. But unfortunately, the confidence was that low at Derby. If I was doing my job, which I couldn't really do anymore, because if I was giving the ball to a technically better player than me, inevitably that ball would come straight back to us because we weren't good enough in possession. So it was very difficult, Jake. I must admit, I was made captain. You know, we brought in players, Danny Mills, who had a wonderful career, Hossam Ghali, Lauren Robert, who, you know, I played against him when he was at Newcastle. Unbelievable on that left-hand side. But, you know, lacked confidence at Derby. The pressure got onto us, the fans. But when I was at Derby, the pressure at playing at home with a full stadium, fans singing, "You're not fit to wear the shirt," laid heavy on us. And it affected me personally, affected the whole side. It was a fear factor playing at home.
Going back towards, I think the Josh King signing, as you said, is a really interesting one. The Callum Wilson partnership you mentioned was sort of almost sort of iconic in Bournemouth staying up every season, and was particularly difficult for the big sides on the counter-attack. Do you think Ancelotti might play him with Calvert-Lewin and try and switch up to a 4-4-2 for some games, or do you reckon he'll sort of play as that wide man? Because he's done both for Bournemouth, but Calvert-Lewin recently not scoring as often as he did at the start. So maybe putting someone up there to buffer him and give James Rodriguez extra target in the box might be the way to go.
Good question. I think what it creates for Ancelotti is an option. Calvert-Lewin's had a remarkable season, balls into the box. You know, what Calvert-Lewin can do better than most in the Premier League is when he jumps, he can stay in the air. You know, he's got a great leap on him. You know, some of his goals this season at the back post have been incredible. But if you can go with a two up front, you know, and that ball gets played diagonally or a straight ball, you know, Calvert-Lewin will win more flick-ons than most. So if you've got Josh King playing up there with him, you know, that partnership could really, really work. And that could be exciting. Or can he play wide? We've seen, you know, Josh King's got the ability to get in behind, you know, defences and put balls across the box for Calvert-Lewin. And if you've got James Rodriguez playing as a 10, you know, in behind those two, all of a sudden, you've got a trio there who can really hurt teams. I've watched Everton's last two games. Listen, I think we've all watched most games of every team this season.
Yeah.
Against Leicester, second half, they defended, they changed system to a back three. They were no threat. Calvert-Lewin could have won it near the end. And then against Newcastle at home, you know, really poor. So it might be that signing. That's why I'm saying this could be a good signing, because every team this season, Jake, has had a blip, hasn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Everton started well, then had a little fall away. Then they've won a couple, then they've had a fall away. So now this is the right time to Josh King. That's why I think he could be a good signing for Ancelotti's side.
Yeah, because just flicking at the table as well, as you said, they've had a recent blip, or they started so well, so everyone's comparing it to that. They've still got two games in hand on the likes of Chelsea, and if they were to win both and go to 36, they'd be back up in the top five, sort of 1 point ahead of West Ham, another surprise package that maybe after that Liverpool game's had its blip. So again, just to finish on the Everton section, do you think the addition of Josh King alone will be enough to secure sort of a Europa League at least spot, or do you think they might still not have quite enough?
Well, I think this season, Jake, this unprecedented season, that if somebody puts a run of four or five games together, who knows what can happen? We've seen Man City. They've had this unbelievable run now. Can't have nobody scores against them. They scored goals. Now the top of the league. And I believe now, what are they? 4 points clear. They got a game in midweek. Obviously, this podcast will go out, so we won't know the result. And then they go to Anfield at the weekend. And if they go to Liverpool and win, I believe Liverpool are City's closest rivals now. You know, Manchester United, I'm not sure they've got enough, or do they believe they can actually go win the Premier League? I think, once again, it's Man City or Liverpool. And if Man City beat Liverpool at Anfield, for me, the title's going to be over. Because you can't concede. Liverpool City don't concede. Yeah. But the run they've put together has enabled them to now, for me, be clear favourites. If Everton can win four or five games in a row, then, yeah, it's a real opportunity. And we've seen Leicester City slip away towards the end of last season. You know, now, was it Leicester? You know, it's is it one point from six? No Jamie Vardy. Hopefully for them, Jamie Vardy be back. Brendan Rodgers, an elite manager, wonderful manager. But you just feel that there's going to be an opportunity for somebody to make that top four. Like an Everton, like just because of the season it is, who knows? Now, if a team can put that run together, it could be that team.
Just quickly then on Leicester as well, because I think last season, again, they were in a similar position and then injuries tore their season apart almost. Lots of key players were lost, including sort of Ricardo Pereira, and I think they lost Maddison and Ndidi for a while. They again, unsurprisingly, as we said, haven't bought anyone in, but they do have these injured players coming back. So sort of first question is, do you think they are going to have enough with players coming back to sort of continue where they are? And I don't know if you had any thoughts on Damari Gray's move to Leverkusen, because I thought that was a really interesting one. A player that I thought was battling with Harvey Barnes, who's been amazing in that winger role, obviously really direct, really quick, but sort of lost his way a bit, and a move to the Bundesliga, as we've seen with Sancho and other English talents, can be really positive for their development.
Listen, I'm a huge fan of Damari Gray. I love how direct, you know, he was, his ability on the ball. And the surprise for me at Leicester is Mark Albrighton. You'd think that Barnes, Vardy, Maddison as a 10, Damari Gray. That's what I would have thought. But you've got to give Mark Albrighton huge amounts of credit for, you know, and getting back in the side and staying in it. So I think it's a great opportunity for Damari Gray by Leverkusen. We know, you know, how well the players have done, as you've said. Bellingham going to Dortmund. So it's a great opportunity for Damari Gray, you know, at a fantastic football club. Am I surprised Leicester have brought nobody in? No. The reason being because they're getting players back. You look at, the recruitment Leicester City have done over the years has been one of the best in the Premier League. They just look at James Justin, what a signing he's been. You look at Pereira, what a signing. Soyuncu, you know, Fofana, brilliant. They're getting these players back now. And Didi, you know, has been out the last game. I think he's close to return, as is Vardy. So I think the lessons they would have learned from last year, the experience gained from missing out, I think that will give them the fuel to get over the line on this occasion. But they need Vardy back. I think before the last couple of games, Jake, since Leicester won the Premier League, their average points per game, with or without Vardy, was exactly the same. The difference was that in the games that they'd won, they'd score, obviously, the average goals per game was more with Vardy. So they do miss him. Of course they do. Any team would miss Jamie Vardy. The question I'd ask is, to people listening to this podcast, which team misses their player more? Vardy, Leicester? Because we've heard it, Jake, haven't we? If Leicester lose Vardy, if Spurs lose Kane, which team misses their player more? Both amazing players. Vardy, Leicester, or Kane, Spurs? It's quite a good debate, that one. Which team misses that player most? You're looking at Leicester, the way they play with Vardy. And the big difference the way they play is when Maddison gets the ball in the final third on the half turn, Leicester have won the most penalties this season in the Premier League. And that's because Maddison, when he gets the ball off one of the defensive midfielders, either Tielemans or Ndidi, on the half turn, he's them little diagonal balls with the runs of Vardy. And if you watch recently, without Vardy, there's not many of those runs. They're more longer balls, or Perez dropping deep and Barnes running in behind. So they've just had to slightly change the way they play. So that's why I think Leicester miss Vardy more than Spurs miss Kane, because Spurs have got Bergwijn, or for me, Son is incredible. Where Leicester really haven't got somebody who threatens. Barnes does. Barnes is still young. So Leicester got players back. I think Brendan Rodgers has done amazingly well. For me, one of the best managers in Europe. And I hope Leicester, you know, get into that top four on this occasion.
So you mentioned there a debate about who is each club's most important player and who misses that player the most. A team that can probably enter themselves into that argument is Wolves, as since Raul Jimenez has been injured, they've really struggled. And again, listeners of this podcast, I actually suggested Wolves might be in a place to be one of those European challenging sides at the start of the season. So after they've lost him, they've made my prediction look quite poor. They did bring in, however, a sort of front man, William Jose from Real Sociedad. They're in 14th at the moment. And in terms of teams that are close to those relegation trio, Sheffield United, West Brom and Fulham, they're only 1 point ahead of Newcastle, Burnley and two ahead of Brighton. Should Wolves fans be worried about them, or will this, again, the same way as Josh King might push Everton for those few extra points needed to get a European place, will the sort of alleviation of William Jose up front help Wolves?
Oh, it's a good question. Listen, don't worry about changing your predictions, Jake. I change mine every single week. and get hammered for it, so don't worry, mate. Wolves, real interesting. You know, I watched them in the Europa League last season when I think it was Jimenez missed a penalty against Sevilla, and then Sevilla scored, I think it was a Campos header late on, and, you know, thought, are they going to build upon last season this year? And Nuno Espirito Santo is a brilliant manager. But I think when we've seen Wolves play, we all know a back three, the way they play. You know, losing Jota and Doherty to Spurs was a blow. The biggest blow of all, you know, Jimenez. You know, Jimenez, hopefully, you know, we'll see him back playing as soon as he can, you know, because a wonderful talent, brilliant player. And as much as the back three were key to the way Wolves played, Jimenez was imperative, absolutely imperative, with the wide players getting balls into the box, the wing backs. So they've missed him massively. And once again, we're going back, Jake, to Vardy, Leicester, Kane, Spurs, Jimenez, Wolves. Centre forwards are paid the most money, usually, because they're the ones who win your games. Defences are so important. You know, titled winning teams are based on good defences. So the whole system at Wolves has been affected by the loss of Jimenez. Nuno trying to adapt, change formations at the back, and they don't look right in a four. William Jose coming in, very hard to adapt to the Premier League. We've seen the youngster, Fabio Silva, £35 million, you know. Probably wasn't going to be ready for this season. Probably was going to be an impact player. You know, so the burden on his shoulders to perform after Jimenez, maybe it's come a bit too quick for him. But people might say, well, it's £35 million. But, you know, that's what you're paying for youngsters, you know, in the transfer market in these days. So I think Wolves is a real strange one. I don't think they'll go down. I think they're too good. The manager's too good. Connor Cody, fantastic leader at the back. Creative players in the middle of the park. I don't think they'll go down. But as Spurs need Kane back, as Leicester need Vardy back, we all want to see Jimenez get back to full fitness and get in that Wolves side, because they miss him massively.
That's all excellent stuff then. I think we've covered as many teams as we can, really, in the short period of time that we've got in your busy schedule. So I'll let you crack on with...
I love it. Listen, great. I love talking football, mate. We all do. I think we're in a very fortunate position at the minute, mate, is that, you know, we are allowed... Personally, I'm allowed to go on to games as a co-commentator, although when I'm on, people probably turn the sound off and they won't know I'm there. But listen, I'm very fortunate to go and watch football still. So listen, mate, I enjoy the podcast. Thanks so much for letting me on.
Now, Mo, I'm coming to you to pick out another winner from the January transfer window. Who have you gone for?
I've gone for a team that didn't sign any players, but signed a manager, Chelsea. I think Chelsea are huge, huge, huge winners of this transfer window, because Frank Lampard, whatever the reason, no judgment, it wasn't working. They looked considerably, markedly worse than last year. All their new signings looked terrible. Venture worked okay. The others didn't look settled in. Hakim Ziyech was obviously creative but stifled. It wasn't working, whatever the reason. Whatever the reason. No judgment. Frank Lampard sucks. Tuchel is brilliant. He's a fantastic coach. I know it all fell apart at PSG and it fell apart at Dortmund, but that's fine for Chelsea because Chelsea never don't look for long-term anyway. If it falls apart within 18 months, that's fine. It's an 18-month deal. He probably won't reach the end of it. What he will do in the meantime is build on the good work that Lampard did do. Some of the good work he did do is bring the young kids through, get the players to club, believing again in hope and good things. And what he's already done, he's had like maybe like four training sessions with the club, maybe maximum. He's already... You can see his impact on them already. It's massive. They've had two clean sheets, zero errors to shot, so in flawless. And what's most impressive is in the two games he's played so far, it's only two games, I know, but still, zero shots on target faced. Over two games, that I know it's, you know, only two games, but that is still impressive. To not have even had, Mendy hasn't even had to make a save. And, but, you know, they're also stepping up their passes, forward passes. They've got the most in the league in their two games. A check rate and chances. So he's got them looking good again. He's gone back to 3-5-2, Conte's 3-4-2-1, really. And it embraces some of the better things about it. So Marcos Alonso now becomes useful again, whereas under Lampard, you know, he can't play left back, so he can't really, what's the point of him? Now he's an option. Ben Chilwell now has a competitor. We've seen how a competitor has driven Luke Shaw to play at his level again. It could be what Ben Chilwell needs to really get that consistency going. You've got it's a central midfield in a 3-4-2-1 is tailor made for N'Golo Kante, so that's perfect. Reece James is probably better at wing back than he is at fullback, so again, that's a perfect fit when he gets his way into the side. Hudson-Odoi now has a permanent fixture in the side if he wants to be as a wing back. That's fantastic. You've got positions for Werner and Havertz where they're not going to be encumbered by having to track back and defend players necessarily. You know, there's almost a ready-made spot in the 11 for Giroud or Abraham. He seems to acknowledge that you need a number 9 in there. You know, it's perfect. And Azpilicueta can always be in the team. And Azpilicueta, whatever else he may not be athletically anymore, is a great leader. And Chelsea always seem to have a bit more about them when he's on the field. I mean, he scored the opening goal in their second game. So finding a way to get him on the field, keep him on the field in a 3-4-2-1, that's huge as well. You know, obviously there's a long way to go and it's only been two games, but you can see already the changes, positive changes that Tuchel has made in the side. Those things will only grow. Havertz is always looking a bit more comfortable than he did under Lampard. And that's huge because we know how good he is. We've seen him for Leverkusen. We've seen how good he is when he has someone to run off, he has someone to feed him in. You know, Ziyech we know is amazing. The talent in the Chelsea team is absurd. You could put two 11s out, I think. Or very close to two completely different 11s out, and each one would be functional. It's a fantastically well put together squad, well organized squad. It just needed someone to harness the power in it, and I think Tuchel is absolutely that guy. It won't last. He's too volatile for it to last, but Chelsea don't need it to last.
So much of that seems quite strange, considering. At the beginning of the season, I'm pretty sure Chelsea weren't facing any shots on target. And this is the reason we spoke about in the last William Hill podcast, the Champions League review. We spoke about how Mendy might not be the saviour. So I guess if he's not having to make a save, then that, again, removes the ability for him to concede goals. But remember Chelsea's clean sheet record at the beginning of the season under Lampard was really positive, and then slowly it became to they stopped scoring and started conceding the sillier goals again. So as you did highlight that it was only two games, but it's interesting that some of the points that you've mentioned there in terms of it being sort of being able to put two 11s out. I think Frank Lampard put three or four different 11s out and couldn't find it.
But that's another thing. Lampard, see, this is you're right. Obviously, they had a clean sheet run at the start of the season. But it's the thing with Lampard is Kepa got worse under Lampard progressively. And he wasn't great to start with. He didn't really settle in perfectly in England, but he was good for Sarri. And he just got markedly worse every time. And Mendy came in under Lampard, looked great. And then slowly, surely, mistakes start gripping into his game. So, again, not to lay all the blame on the coaches, but when a player's can get worse, the longer they spend under your care, you know, I'm not looking at the players and blaming them. So, I think To show a Star Trek world just like Lampard did, but I don't think there'll be a similar drop-off. There might be, who knows, but I would be more inclined to say that more likely what's going to happen is players will get better. And the defined system is going to be huge because Lampard was chopping and changing the playing this week, the playing that week. He kept saying, I want us to be versatile. Being versatile is great, but you have to know, you have to have a key way of playing, or understanding way of playing. And Chelsea's way of playing under Frank Lampard was basically just, look, Mason Mount is great. Let's just give him the ball. He'll drive us forward. And that's what happened. And it kind of halfway worked because Mount is so good and so full of energy that it just lifts everyone else around him, right? And Chelsea have enough talented players besides them to make it work. Now it's like Mount is not an essential part of this now new lineup, but he can now fit into the lineup. So now it's like, oh, I can bring, and they can put Mount in one of the two roles, as he did in the second game, put Mount in one of the two roles behind the striker. Then he has even less defensive roles. He can really push on and really get involved. And, you know, it's a small sample size, but I just think the difference in the quality of the coach is going to tell over the long run. We've seen this with Man City. We've seen this with Liverpool. It never started off well. It started off okay, and there were mistakes, and there were bumps, and you know, this and that. But over the time, having a good coach makes a huge difference. Look at, I mean, bad example right now, but look at Southampton, you know, under Ralph Hasenhüttl. Good coaches, it tells over time, and that's what's going to happen with Tuchel.
But then how long do you think he's going to be there? I mean,
well, yeah.
Long enough,
yeah,
that makes a bit of a difference.
That's the thing that I thought was almost contradictory, is that you've said that the platform is built now for them to be winners because they've hired a good coach for these good players, but then he's almost coming in as sort of an emergency coach to just coach them for 18 months, but then they're going to get someone new to come in that might undo all of that work, and then it becomes a case of short-term, what's the maximum short-term win they can get? Tuchel, I think, admitted that the league title is really far off. And although this season has been absolutely crazy, I'm not sure they have a chance of winning that. And then in the Champions League, he obviously got to the final with the PSG, lost that. And Frank Lampard's Chelsea team's record in the group stage was actually fantastic. I think they did only concede one goal in that. So Tuchel's first two games, not having a shot on target against a Wolves side bereft of confidence, sitting super deep, and a Burnley side coming back off a 1-0 Anfield win and sitting super deep. It's unlikely that they were going to face many shots in those games anyway. So I'm just saying, Mo, we hear your podcasts and read your articles probably more than anyone. And I think there was that one time that you called Lampard's Chelsea as being genuine title contenders. So it's interesting to see what changed so dramatically.
I called Lampard. I said that team looked good because they did look really good. But then that was also predicated on the fact that the players wouldn't get worse. Hakim Ziyech wouldn't get worse. Timo Werner wouldn't get worse. And they did. They all got, everyone started slumping and Lampard started, you know. So I didn't advocate for every single Chelsea player suddenly becoming worse, which admittedly was maybe an oversight. But the decline in Chelsea was, with the exception for Mount, obviously, who has continued to be excellent. I don't think it's anything anyone could have really predicted. It was, there were criticisms of Lampard. I've been a critic of Lampard since he got the job. I've said, you know, is he good enough? You know, he's doing the bare minimum, but it's okay. But sometimes there comes a point when doing the bare minimum, keeping everyone happy, isn't enough. And, you know, you get found out as, oh, okay, yeah, he doesn't actually know what he's doing, like certain other managers in the group stage of the Champions League playing away in Turkey. But, you know, this is what happens. But this is why I think Tuchel is going to be good. And even, I know, yes, that 18 months is not a long time, but it could be enough time for him to do really good things with Chelsea's great players. Remember, Chelsea's squad is not only talented, it's actually quite young, with the exception of Giroud and Azpilicueta. I think all their key players are under 30. I don't think Kante's 30 yet. So they've got a young team. So even if Lampard did well to get a lot of young players through and to get everyone sort of motivated in a very direction and get Mason Mount established as a Chelsea player and Billy Gilmore and Tammy Abraham, Reece James and all that lot. So now if Tuchel comes on and builds on that, now Tuchel might not win anything necessarily, but if Tuchel comes on and builds on that and improves all of those players, gets them all happier and playing, as long as the next guy that they come in, this could be the setup for an era of actual domination from whoever, if they get the next managerial appointment correct, because the work Tuchel will do it.
But how are they winners now then? If it's all predicated on the next manager,
the right coach. They've got an actual coach who's going to coach their players and improve their players. It's going to work. Trust me.
Why didn't they just sign good coaches for Lampard then?
Well, they did try Anthony Parry to help with set pieces, and they got better at set pieces. But, you know, he can't sign, like, they would have to sign a whole army of coaches to do everything for him because he wasn't very good at it. So, you know.
Interesting. Do you think they've got a chance of winning anything under Tuchel this season, or do you think there's too much sort of, as you said, it's a young squad and it's a very new squad with all of those players that were added. So whoever is the manager, you do have to find out your best team with only two people can play behind the one striker, only two people can play in midfield, and they've got about eight options for those. So that's difficult in itself.
Yeah, but I think one thing that will allow them to do is almost juggle Europe and a league run simultaneously with greater ease. Like, so they could do something in Champions League. They could be contenders for the FA Cup. Let's not rule them out there. I don't think they'll win the league, although honestly, like you said, with this season, anything, who knows what could happen. But I think they've done very well to get in a good coach that's going to actually help them build on what the great transfer summer they had. Although I will also say another club that I think did pretty good work late in the window was Arsenal. I thought, as much as everyone likes to laugh at them, you know, and especially after their Wolves game, you know, how can you not laugh at them? But they did really well. They cut a lot of deadwood out of their squad, and Martin Odegaard is potentially a very, very special signing. Although creates other problems with the team, I guess.
It's a shame they don't have a purchase option for him. I know Real Madrid were reluctant to sell him to Sociedad, but their financial situation still isn't ideal by any stretch. So I wonder if there is any scope for that to be made permanent. I think Arteta's already talking about wanting to keep him beyond this loan arrangement. But the fact it is 6 months isn't ideal, especially when Smith Rowe has come in and done so well in that number 10 position, which I think... you know, it's assumed that Odegaard will play in. So it'll just be interesting to see the dynamics of that and how that all fits together.
Yeah, that's what I was hinting at, because it's the funny thing is, obviously, I think the reason there was no purchase clause is because Madrid want to sell. Madrid want to make as much money as possible. And the potential, if Odegaard plays well, then the price will rocket up, won't it? And I mean, and of course, maybe the next coach of Madrid, it won't be Zidane next season, probably will want Odegaard. I don't know. He's very good. But the other thing is, yeah, that's what I hinted at. The kids are actually, because Odegaard plays in two positions and they're both occupied right now by two
Saka and Smith Rowe.
Youngsters. I mean, Smith Rowe is good. Smith Rowe is great. He creates a lot of energy. But Saka has been outrageous lately. He's, come on. I mean, it's absurd to say, because obviously he was great anyway when we saw him last season develop. But he seems to have gotten even better in like the last couple of months. Like, he's just, come on. I mean, since Aubameyang's been out of the team, really.
That's what I was going to say is, you mentioning that the young players are performing too well to be dropped. Aubameyang, due to unfortunate circumstances, has had to drop out of the team. But and again, you say the way the Wolves defeat ended was obviously a circus with the two red cards and the stunning goals, etc. But in the first 45 minutes until the penalty was awarded, Arsenal probably played some of their best football of the season, and Aubameyang was not in the team. Pepe on the left-hand side now with Saka on the right, which, again, as you said, Saka's development been so rapid. I thought he was best on the left-hand side, and it turns out he seems to be Arsenal's best right winger as well. So
he can actually play anywhere, can't he?
Maybe the biggest loser from Erdegaard's arrival, if they're desperate to play him, is the fact that Aubameyang, who was the saviour of last season and signed his new deal in typical Arsenal fashion, and after praising them for getting rid of lots of deadwood, and I'm not calling Aubameyang deadwood, but he's their highest earner, and now all of a sudden maybe they play better without him in the side.
It's Mesut Ozil all over again, isn't it? Lacazette has totally rooted this, hasn't he? He was like derided, but he's quietly just scored goals, and now he's surrounded by mobile young players. He's come to life as a target man, as a hold-up man. And yeah, I agree with you. The Wolves thing ended in fast, but that was never a penalty, never a red card. And before then, Arsenal were just flying. They were playing really well. Saka's great. Pepe on the left, in like counterintuitively, given how he played before. Do you think this didn't work? And he's actually brilliant. I think he's also hit the gym because he's holding off defenders a lot better now as well. But he looks like transformed. And it's in, like you said all along, Jake, if Arsenal have players that can carry the ball, it makes a massive difference. So Pepe can dribble, Smith Rowe can dribble, Saka can dribble, and suddenly Arsenal actually look like, oh, hang on a minute, when they're in possession, it's not just pass, 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 pass. Please, Granit Xhaka, find a miracle ball from somewhere. It's actually movement, and you know, it's not just real. And then Tierney wasn't even playing. So once you get him back, it's, you know, the team is actually good. You can plug Odegaard in. So it's looking good, as much as the Wolves game was, you know, an obstacle.
They definitely are making progress in their transfer strategy over the last two windows, I think, aside from the Willian deal, which just does, like, makes less and less sense each week. You know, they are putting building blocks in place, I think, to rebuild, which has been long overdue. They had a squad that was so stale that they've had to literally cancel players' contracts this month just to get rid of them. But the building blocks are there. Gabriel is a good signing, even though he's not played much recently. Pablo Maria is a good squad player. Odegaard is the right type of player. If they can't get him permanently, then at least his signing shows that they want someone young who can press but also create in a way that Ozil was unable to. So they are showing signs of a coherent strategy for the first time in God knows how long. But yeah, and I think they are finally learning lessons. I mean, losing four players, three contracts were terminated, Mustafi, Ozil and Sokratis, and Kolasinac has gone out on loan, I think, but will join Schalke at the end of the season. Losing players in those circumstances is obviously not ideal at all. I think they paid just shy of 100 million for four of them, and they've all gone for nothing. So that's not good business. But the fact that they've been able to get them out and are now able to replenish the squad with young players who are hungry and actually want to play for the club and will be receptive to Arteta's ideas, I think is a massive bonus for Arsenal. So yeah, it's been a good window for them, but obviously there is that caveat that their transfer business over the last 10 years has just been shown up to have been farcical, really. But yeah, there's definitely progress being made.
Freed up the 10 for Smith Rowe, freed up the 5 for Thomas Partey. It's all good. Yeah. It's all good.
Yeah, Partey as well. Another one in the summer. It's like they're making smart signings, which is not something you would attribute to Arsenal over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
And now to finish this episode, we're going to look beyond the Premier League and into Europe. Again, according to the Guardian Transfer Interactive Tracker, 447 deals worth 260 million were completed, as we've mentioned a lot. A lot of loan deals, which means that figure is much lower than before. So to finish it off, I'm going to go to each guest and ask them to pick out a signing that you might have missed from Europe or one that intrigues and interests them the most. And to start this section, going to go to Will for your transfer you might have missed.
So my pick isn't very glam, but I think it will draw both Ollie and Mo into the discussion in different ways. And it definitely fits the criteria of transfers that you might have missed, because I actually did miss this because it took place before the window actually opened. But Etienne Capoue to Villarreal for around about £1 million. Goes from Watford in the Championship to a Europa League club in Villarreal. And it's probably a kind of move he deserved a year or two ago, having been an underrated player with wider audiences, though very much appreciated by Watford fans. Overshadowed by Doucouré a little, maybe, who actually got his big-ish move to Everton. But yeah, I think low-key king of interceptions. He's gone straight over in the Premier League over the past couple of years. He's gone straight into the Villarreal starting 11, forming a pretty mid-2010s centre midfield partnership with Francis Coquelin.
I was going to say, North London rivals become best friends. And they also have Dani Parejo as well, don't they? Villarreal in general, under Unai Emery, they absolutely blitzed Valencia for every player in the summer transfer. And then, as you said, I think Etienne Capoue was linked with Valencia right until the last moment. And then Villarreal said, well, we just want him as well. Which compounds Valencia's sorry state of affairs at the moment. And as you said, also interesting to see how he steps up. One of those players that was considered too good, I guess, for the championship based on his previous pedigree.
Yeah, and he's of course he's one of the bail money seven, so a little bit tainted by that, but then slowly rebuilt his reputation up.
That yeah, Lamella's the last link
to draw Ollie into the conversation.
I was drawn in slowly but surely. Lamella's the last surviving one, of course, of the magnificent, not so magnificent seven.
Ollie, well, as you weren't drawn into it as much as probably Will wanted you to be, who's your interesting transfer pick from Europe?
So I've gone for Damari Gray, who has joined Leverkusen from Leicester. He's a bit of a forgotten man at Leicester. He played 18 minutes in the Premier League this season, which came against Crystal Palace on December 28th when Rodgers made a whole raft of changes to cope with the festive schedule. So he's not played at all, really. He only made three Premier League starts in 2019-20 as well. And he's basically been a perennial substitute at Leicester. He made 133 Premier League appearances for them, 60% of which came as a substitute. So he's not really played much football. The emergence of Harvey Barnes and Brendan Rodgers' experiment with a back five at times has limited his chances, and now he's gone to the Bundesliga, which has been home to a lot of English wingers, of course, over the past few years. Jadon Sancho is the obvious one, but Ademola Lookman and Reece Nelson have also had spells in the Bundesliga, so he'll be looking to emulate their successes short-term in the case of Lookman and Nelson, and longer-term in Sancho. But it is quite an interesting move. When he went to Leicester, he was very highly regarded. He joined them at a very, very good time, midway through the 15-16 season, winning the Premier League there. And he also had another big moment for them, scoring their first goal and the match winner following the death of Kun Vichai, their former owner. But things have gone sour for him, and it'll be interesting to see how he bounces back under Peter Bosch at Leverkusen. They had quite an interesting window all round, actually. They signed Timothy Fosu-Mensah as well from Man United, and also Jeremy Frimpong from Celtic. So a proper football manager transfer window from Leverkusen, this.
Leverkusen are a football manager club, like proper. Like their signings, their style of play, everything.
Yeah. Well, the Damari Gray one, his contract was up at the end of this season. So they've obviously gone on the shortlist and set it to expiring 6 months and snapped him up for $3 million. So it's only an 18-month deal, so which suggests they're not hugely convinced by his long-term potential. He's still only 24, Damari Gray, so be interesting to see how he gets on. But he's also going to be competing with Leon Bailey and Moussa Diaby for a place in the team. So it's going to be tough for him. I mean, he's not played much football at Leicester, and those two are two of Leverkusen's best players. So, yeah. Have to see how he gets on.
Great minds think alike, because we asked, obviously, Robbie Savage for his thoughts on Damari Gray being former Leicester as well, and as people would have heard, we're recording them at different times, but he gave his thoughts on that previously. You mentioned there about Leon Bailey and Moussa Diaby to lean on Damari Gray a bit more as we've got more time now. Maybe his signing is in case. Leon Bailey in particular is someone that's been linked to a lot of Premier League clubs and big clubs in general. And Moussa Diaby, I think, is super exciting. So perhaps the Damari Gray signing is someone for backup at the moment. But if they were to have to sell one of those sort of premium young wingers they've got, then they can sort of give Damari Gray a new contract when he's settled in, if at all. But maybe he's part of a longer term plan as well to try and not be left in a lurch should one of their sort of informed wingers be signed.
It could be a similar case to Leicester. They were probably making contingency plans for Mahrez eventually going as well, and maybe thought, you know, Gray could be the one to step up. And although he showed flashes, he scored a wonderful goal at Old Trafford, I remember, and had a few other good moments, but he never really had a sustained run in the team. And then, as I said, Harvey Barnes's emergence and Mark Albrighton's return to favour has sort of meant that he's not played at all. But yeah, I mean, he's joining a good side. They're fifth in the Bundesliga, 1 point off the top four. I've got a lot of good young players aside from Bailey and Diaby. They've got Florian Wirtz, who can play out wide as well, 17-year-old, and a few others as well. So yeah, they've got an exciting squad, and yeah, hopefully he can regain some of the promise that he showed at Birmingham before moving to Leicester and in patches in the Premier League as well.
Mo, who's your interesting European signing that people may have missed, or one that you just couldn't resist talking about?
I don't think anyone missed it, but definitely I can't resist talking about it. It's Papu Gomez to Sevilla. It's just the ultimate hipster signing, plus also just actually a really, really good signing. Papu Gomez, as everyone knows, obviously the chief architect of this fantastic Will Hall's Atalanta. You know, fantastic Serie A side, thrilled us, you know, and Champions League took us by storm. And he's obviously he fell out with Gianpiero Gasperini and has left in January. Bold call from Atalanta, but there you go. And he's gone to Sevilla. And I think this is the perfect blend of player and club. Because first of all, he's going from a coach in Gasperini, attention to detail, focused on attacking team, pressing, to Lopetegui, who is similar-minded, a very attacking coach, likes to press, likes to be coordinated. And, you know, he fits seamlessly into the system as well. This is the thing. Obviously, Sevilla, since the start of last season, have created the third most chances in La Liga. They've scored the third most goals, kept the third most clean sheets, kept the third most, conceded the third most goals, right? So they're basically the third or fourth best team in the country, right? Attacking-wise, they're probably the third best. Atletico Madrid, better defensively, but whatever. They need something to go to the next level, to actually be able to compete with Atletico. I mean, Barcelona really compete with them this season because they're having down years, but when they rebound as well, Sevilla needs something to take them to that next level, to make them a genuinely elite side. And I think Papu Gomez is the guy, in all honesty, because you look at him, he's just a creative phenomenon. Since the start of last season, 18 assists, 18 big chances, 121 chances. Atalanta are the foremost attacking side in Serie A. Most goals, most assists, most chances, all that stuff. And he's at the heart of it. So you plug him in that attacking three with, obviously, Lucas Campos, another player that a fantastic young Argentine, well, not young now, but fantastic Argentine winger, great dribbler, great goal scorer. And crucially, Youssef En-Nesyri, who previously looked a dynamic player, but wasn't necessarily a great finisher. And which was kind of Sevilla's problem, is they've been solid defensively for a while under Lopetegui, thanks to Jules Koundé and Diego Carlos in particular. But they've lacked a sort of goal-scoring punch. Luke de Jong wasn't really prolific, but he held the ball up well. En-Nesyri wasn't really prolific, but he ran in behind well, gave him dynamism. So he had to kind of pick his poison every game, which striker suits them. Kind of like Leverkusen did with Oliver Neuville and Dimitar Berbatov, God, 20 years ago now. But with En-Nesyri now, he's scored two hat-tricks since the start of the year. Now, that could just be a purple patch, but the thing is, Papu Gomez coming in right when he's in his purple patch, you have another chance to make that into just actually now this is how En-Nesyri plays all the time. This is his new form. Because Papu Gomez will increase the amount of chances he gets provided with so much and increase the attacking frequency of Sevilla's play by such a degree that now maybe En-Nesyri just does score goals all like this all the time. You know, maybe he does score maybe 25, 20, 30 goals a season because he's got Papu Gomez loading the bullets for him. And maybe now you so instead of just being, oh, he's in a good bit of form, maybe this is his new form. And it could be exactly what Sevilla... And forget, even if they don't get all the results they want, they're going to be great fun to watch now. They're going to be so much fun to watch now with all the players. They've got all the fun players, Juan Jordan, Papu Gomez, Jesus Navas, the reborn Jesus Navas, the reborn Fernando. Koundé is a box-to-box centre-back. You know, they're just going to be great fun to watch. So, Papu Gomez to Sevilla, banger of a signing.
The Ebenega replacement, if not going to be slightly positioned more in a more advanced role, the sort of ultra creative, super slick midfielder. And again, obviously an easy comparison to make, I guess, because of the Argentinian nationality they both share. Interesting, as you said, Sevilla themselves, obviously Europa League winners last year, looking solid, if anything else. In the Champions League, they're actually quite a long way, 40-1 to obviously win it. And I guess that's fair considering the power of other sides in the competition. But a matchup against Dortmund is it's not an easy draw, but given Dortmund's sort of instability and the changing of the coach and conceding a lot of goals, essentially, Sevilla might be someone to look at as going fairly far in the Champions League with the addition of Papu Gomez, in my opinion, because he already has that experience of carrying Atalanta through to the latter stages last season. As you said, he set the record last season for most assists in a Serie A campaign recorded by Opta. So his pedigree to add that clinical touch that might help them in these big games is something to look out for, I think.
I mean, the big worry against Dortmund is Diego Carlos fouling Erling Haaland or Jadon Sancho for a penalty. Because obviously Dortmund's great weapon is speed, but in Jules Koundé, Sevilla have literally one of the fastest centre-backs in the world. So if anyone can match Haaland for speed, and I'm not sure, I'm not saying Koundé can, I'm not sure anyone can, but if anyone can, it's Koundé. And yeah, Dortmund are all over the place at the back. So that's, you know, this is where, like you said, Papu Gomez is such a great creative player. You plug him into that. It basically just makes it even more of a mouth-watering tie than it already was. It was already like, oh, that's going to be great. It's going to be even more impressive now. Like, you're just hoping for like a full-on, like each game is like 4-3 or something, you know?
Mm. Yeah, and we obviously spoke about that game a lot, especially the penalties that Haaland might win in the Champions League preview we did, which seems an age ago now. But just to round off on this transfer episode, obviously we've had three signings there. Just to recap, another one that I picked out, again, that I won't go into, but Dominic Szoboszlai, who was rumoured to be the player Arsenal were chasing for that creative role, hasn't played for RB Leipzig yet, but was signed right at the beginning of the window. And again, according to what I have in front of me from The Guardian, he was the most expensive transfer in January. And then you have people like Sebastian Haller, who's now gone to Ajax and seems to be assisting every game in a team that is with more attacking freedom or just wasn't quite suited to the Premier League. Interesting to see how Morgan Sanson does at Aston Villa. Again, Will, I know that you've been involved in some articles that Squawker have produced that have sort of almost painted him as a Jack Grealish light in terms of his output, which might help, again, balance their attacking output a bit more, despite Jack Grealish himself being absolutely world-beating form this season. But that wraps up this William Hill transfer window special. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Mo, Ollie and Will, thank you for joining, and we'll speak to you again in another episode coming soon.